Hello, I'm Dan Jurgen, Vice Chairman of IHS Market, and I want to welcome you to a CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market with Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska. Dan has a distinguished career in the military. He's been an Assistant Secretary of State. He's also been Commissioner of Natural Resources in Alaska, and since 2014, Senator from the state of Alaska. We'll be talking about energy in Alaska, nationally and internationally, infrastructure, the oceans, competition in the Arctic, relations with China, and also we'll be talking about, despite what you read in the media, that actually how the U.S. government works. So, Senator Sullivan, welcome very much to CERAWeek.
Dan, great to be back at CERAWeek. Always great to be with you.
Thank you. We appreciate very much you joining us in this virtual CERAWeek. Let me dive in just with the first question. How's the country doing dealing with COVID-19?
Well, look, obviously it's a huge challenge that, everybody's had to come together on. And, you know, from my perspective, particularly the legislative perspective, it's been positive. We've actually passed four pieces of major legislation, including the CARES Act, especially the CARES Act, since March. These have been very, very bipartisan pieces of legislation. But, you know, all of this legislation, Dan, has been challenged because we in the Congress and the Senate, we didn't really have a crystal ball. So when we passed the CARES Act, we put a lot of things in there that we were anticipating, but we really weren't sure as we saw this pandemic kind of bearing down on our country. So what you're seeing now is the implementation certainly has been rocky, I would say, but anytime you pass legislation that huge, it's going to have some bumps in the road. One of the programs that I really advocated for, the Paycheck Protection Program, Treasury Department estimates that that may have saved upwards of 40 million jobs, keeping Wow. employers and employees connected. That was the entire point of that legislation. But yet you saw even last week in the Senate, we tweaked that after hearing certainly from Alaskans on how to make that better for small businesses. So it's, of course, the balance between the physical health of our citizens, but also the economic health that can relate, that can impact physical Sure. health. And so I think, with some bumpy starts, no doubt, the testing obviously got off to a very rough start. I think things are starting to improve, but we're not out of the woods yet.
How's it been going in Alaska?
You know, it's a couple things. We've had a very low number of cases. I think our governor and his medical team have been doing a really good job. But of course, it's this balance. Just lately, as we've started to open up our economy, we've seen a number of spikes in terms of the cases with regard to the COVID-19 virus. Of course, there's a real long and difficult history with our native communities where there's a lot of trepidation with good reason. You know, when the Spanish flu finally hit Alaska, it killed more people per capita in Alaska than any place in the country. So there's trepidation there, but we're doing well. For example, we have one of the highest per capita rates of testing of any state in the country. But the real challenge, Dan, it's not just the health challenge. Our economy's been really, really hurt by this. I mean, probably more than most economies. Obviously, our energy sector, which was having a great season in January and February, is taking it on the chin like so many other energy sectors. Our tourism sector, our fisheries sector. We're a tough, resilient people in Alaska. And, you know, what I like to say, tough times don't last, tough people do. And we'll get through this more stronger, more resilient. But it's a challenging time in the great state of Alaska right now.
And of course, you're able, the feedback from Alaska, from what you hear there, that helps you look at the overall legislative packages that are coming out.
Absolutely. You know, some of the ideas that I have gotten, a lot of the ideas that I have gotten are direct meetings. I've been doing teletown halls. I've been doing all kinds of outreach, probably busier than ever, interestingly. And a lot of those ideas we have directly pressed for at the highest levels of government. Some we got in the CARES Act. There's a fisheries disaster relief fund. There's a tribal fund. Those are all things that I advocated for, got in the original bill. But other things, We got in later, like a seasonal business fix.
A lot of investment has come into the state now in activity. But we also see energy companies cutting their budgets 30 to 50% in terms of spending. How does Alaska, which is energy so important, how does it remain competitive?
Well, look, it's a really, really important question. And as you mentioned, it's a balance between what we, you know, from a tax perspective, charge the companies and what the state keeps. That's important. And also, and then, you know, Dan, this is a big passion of mine. From the regulatory perspective, it's also important to keep, from my view, having timeliness and certainty in our regulatory process, whether at the state level, but particularly at the federal level. But as you mentioned, you know, the great thing about Alaska, it's not if, but when you find big, really, even now, conventional fields. I know you had Ryan Lance on recently, but, you know, Conoco had a huge exploration program this past winter in Alaska. Some of the other independents up there, and they're finding big billion barrel conventional fields. Some of the smartest people I know in the oil and gas industry are rightfully saying Alaska's the hottest play in the world right now.
Maintaining that competitiveness is really important to the economy of the state. And sometimes people don't quite see that, particularly in this new environment.
Absolutely. It's critical. And we'll keep it there. You know, I think between our state government and the federal government, the Trump administration has been very, very pro-energy. I've had a number of discussions with the president. But like I said, you know, Alaska, we've been through these rough times before. Anyone who's counted us out has always lost on that bet. So don't count us out. Like I said, there is so much happening in terms of exploration. And we will get our fiscal regime right. That matters to the competitiveness that you're talking about, and you know, getting through this rough time in the energy sector is going to be critical, not just for Alaska, by the way, for America.
Yeah, well, Dan, one area, one group, some people, at least from what I read from letters that you've been writing, who are counting Alaska out are financial institutions.
Oh.
And you've stepped in pretty strongly to challenge banks that have decided not to support investment in Alaska. What's been the impact? How's that going? Why are you doing that?
To be honest, I'm quite disappointed in some of the big banks in America. You know, they get pressure from the radical left, and I'm going to be a little political here. Some of my Democratic colleagues have extreme views, Green New Deal, all this craziness, and they get pressure from them and they cave. I mean, that's my view. They cave and they don't get any countervailing pressure. So what I've done, and I've talked to the president and his team quite extensively about this, I led a letter, 36 senators and congressmen, a really good group. We wrote the president saying, you know, these big financial institutions, they certainly get a lot of federal government support. Heck, they're FDIC insured. A bunch of them are going to make tons of money implementing the CARES Act because that's all federal government guaranteed loans. And some of them were even bailed out, wouldn't even exist right now. If it weren't for the federal government in 2008 and 2009 during the financial crisis. And yet they are now going to decide that they can discriminate against entire critical sector of the U.S. economy that's legal, that's creditworthy, and that's really important to America, really important to Alaska. So I have been reaching out not just to the president and his team, but to regulators, federal regulators, saying, hey, look at these laws. Look at these laws. My view is I don't think these banks are allowed to do this. Certainly the discrimination that is directed exactly in some of our biggest native communities in Alaska, the North Slope Borough. You may have seen the mayor of the North Slope Borough. Harry Brower wrote a really powerful op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, what are you banks up to? You know, the people I represent, the Nupiat people, amazing people, great Americans. You know, a generation ago, they were some of the poorest people in the world. They've made huge advancements in health and the economy, jobs, because of the energy sector. And now we have big Wall Street banks saying they're going to redline and not invest in this sector. I think these banks need to watch very carefully. My own view is I think they're bumping up against several federal laws. But my next step is a letter to all the chairman of the Fed, the chairman of the FDIC, the chairman of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency saying, they take a hard look at these banks. The good news is I've had talks with some CEOs, and a lot of them are not going to follow suit, but some really big banks have done this, and I think they're making a mistake, and I think they might be making a legal mistake. I've read the law, and I think they're bumping up against a lot of federal laws that that prohibit this kind of discriminatory lending practices.
Right. Well, you've also written letters in another realm, which is when the oil price collapsed. And of course, you have emphasized how important the shale revolution has been to the United States.
When the pandemic hit, and I'm sure most of the people watching here remember this, kind of it's not a great memory, that's for sure. But we obviously had this huge demand destruction with regard to the U.S. economy, the global economy, all really kind of cratering at that time. For whatever reason, and you know, I've read some intel indicating there's certain reasons, the Saudis decided to undertake a price war with the Russians. And you might remember the Crown Prince announced in early March that they were going to move, ramp up production to 12.3 million barrels a day. That's a very significant ramp up, even for Saudi Arabia. Within the next couple of days, oil prices cratered an additional 30 to 40% globally. Well, you know, I did lead a group of 13 senators to write the Crown Prince in rather frank terms, saying we have been strong supporters of the U.S.-Saudi strategic relationship for many years. But right now, you're taking actions that are clearly aimed at and are hurting the people we represent by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. These are great Americans, their families, you know, hardworking union workers. And we're not going to tolerate this. So I introduced legislation with Senator Cramer of North Dakota to remove all U.S. military forces from Saudi Arabia, all of our missile defense systems that protect that country. I think we certainly got their attention. As I think you know, our ambassador is a great ambassador to Saudi Arabia, General John Abizaid, former U.S. commander of U.S. Central Command. And I served under him as a Marine major. I was a staff officer directly working for General Abizaid for a year and a half in CENTCOM in 05 and 06. He and others indicated that our views were being heard and they were being taken seriously. And then we worked very closely with the president, the Secretary of Energy, and their team on this OPEC deal. The president deserves a ton of credit on that. And the Saudis committed to me that beyond the OPEC deal, that if additional action they thought was needed, they would take it. They did. May have seen the announcement of an additional million barrels a day off the market from the Saudi production. So right now they are targeting 7.5 million barrels a day versus 12.3. That's a pretty dramatic decrease. We're going to continue to watch this very closely. Those 13 senators are some of the strongest supporters of that U.S.-Saudi relationship. Right.
Of course, you have served in the Middle East and through various crises, so.
Yes, sir. And I'm a colonel in the Marines. I'm still serving in the reserves. Matter of fact, I'm the only senator still in the military.
Dan, I know that infrastructure has been one of the items at the top of your agenda since you've been in the Senate. You've done a lot on it. Everybody likes the notion of infrastructure. Sometimes it seems not a lot happens. Where do we stand on moving infrastructure legislation?
I hope we're close, and I do think we're close. Let me just give you a couple examples. I'm on the Environment and Public Works Committee. That's where all the action is. We've already passed out the next five-year highway bill. You know, that's really important. It gives people the opportunity to plan. We had not done a five-year highway bill until the Republicans retook the Senate in 2014 for almost 20 years. It was these, what I consider not very effective, just short-term extensions. So we said, we're going to come in here, a five-year bill. We got that done. It expires in the fall. So we already have another one ready to go. It's very bipartisan, 21-0 actually out of the committee. And then just 3 weeks ago, we marked up what's called a WERDA bill. It's essentially the ports, harbors, bridges bill. Again, 21-0. So our goal is to combine these together and move them hopefully in a package sometime this summer. So there's definite action. You know, another area for me as Alaska's senator that I'm very passionate about is infrastructure that relates to water and sewer funding. Believe it or not, we have over 30 communities in my great state where Alaskans living in those communities don't have flush toilets, they don't have running water. So American citizens living in places where you don't have any running water or flush toilets, I think it's an outrage. I think the pandemic has really highlighted the need for these kind of things. When CDC says, hey, wash your hands several times a day, and you live in a community without running water, it's pretty darn hard to do that. So I'm pressing on the water and sewer funding as well, particularly for my state. But I'm hopeful that we're going to make progress on this. And then finally, you and I have talked a lot about it. All of these bills, every time I try to get major permitting reform in these infrastructure packages, this is just common sense. When it takes 8 or 9 years to permit a bridge in America, you know, we had a gold mine in our great state, finally got permitted with the litigation after 20 years.
Well, I think you have.
We have to do a much better job on our permitting at the federal level. And as you know, I'm very passionate.
I think you had an example of a runway that took 17 years to get permitted.
Yes, it was a hearing, a runway at the SeaTac Airport in Seattle, a new runway. Between the time they built it and got the permits, I asked the witness a question. I said, how long did it take? He said, 15 years. And I couldn't believe it. The whole committee kind of gasped. And then he looked at me and he said, Senator, I believe the Egyptians built the Great Pyramids in a shorter amount of time. So we got work to do. You can throw as much money as you want in terms of permitting, but if you can't get projects done quickly, it's kind of a waste of money.
So do you see progress on permitting?
There's some. You know, I have this bill called the Rebuild America Now Act. That's the real big NEPA reform. We haven't gotten anything that far, but the president and his team have done a great job on an executive order that actually took a lot of things from my Rebuild America Now Act. Shot clocks, timelines on permitting. This isn't about cutting corners. This is just about common sense, singular decisions by federal agencies, not letting, you know, some of the radical green groups sue at the last minute to delay. So these are common sense approaches that I think should have bipartisan support. So we're seeing some progress. We're seeing a lot of progress on the executive agency side with this administration. What I'd like to see is the permanent progress in legislation. That's a little tougher, but we'll keep working it.
You've been at the forefront of addressing our waste in the oceans and working with the Alliance to end plastic waste. Where does that stand?
Well, look, Dan, this is a really good news story. You know, one of my frustrations in this job is kind of hard to get it out into the media, but I had a bill last Congress called the Save Our Seas Act. It was all about ocean cleanup, ocean debris, mostly about the cleanup part. And that passed, signed into law. It was actually an Oval Office signing. I've talked to the president and his team about this, really pressed them to include this issue of ocean cleanup in a lot of the executive things that they're doing. I think they're really starting to focus on that. You may have seen the USMCA, the new NAFTA, has an entire section on fisheries, which was something that I put in the Trade Promotion Authority legislation, but a section on ocean cleanup. And this is first time in a trade agreement. So my co-sponsor, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, he and I, when our bill got passed, we got right to work on Save Our Seas 2.0, SOS 2.0. That's very comprehensive. It passed the Senate in January unanimously. The Congressional Research Service called it the most comprehensive ocean cleanup legislation ever.
Right. And you and Senator Whitehouse are not on the same side of the political spectrum.
Oh, no, not at all. But we're actually really good friends, right? We just disagree, particularly on energy issues. But, you know, we agree on other things like this. So, and that's the way I believe you should be working here in a bipartisan way. If you have principal differences, okay, I'm not going to agree with him on, you know, opening ANWR. But I'm working closely with him on the ocean cleanup legislation. Now it's all over in the House. It's actually starting to move in the House. So we're hopeful. And here's the big reason why, how we worked hard on this. Our goal was to get the key Ocean Conservancy environmental groups, which they were great, to get industry. You mentioned the Alliance to End Plastic Waste. That's a lot. It's about the Fortune 50 companies. some energy companies, a number of energy companies, that have pledged $1.5 billion to clean up our oceans. That's a lot of money from the private sector. Democrats and Republicans in the Congress, which we're doing in the Trump administration, which has been part of our legislation, bringing everybody together, all those key stakeholders. We've done that. Now we got to get the House to pass it. And that's how you get major important pieces of legislation done. And we're doing that.
But a lot of it, I mean, we know that most of the plastic waste in the ocean comes from 10 rivers that are not in the United States, but in Correct. Asia and Africa. Does this legislation work with other countries to address?
Yes, absolutely. It's got a big component here on our own domestic infrastructure as it relates to waste management and recycling. It's got a lot on the area of innovation. It has a genius prize that really is set up to help. The technology is close. We're not there yet. Again, the American Chemistry Council was very supportive of our bill. You know, if we could crack the code to be able to have a plastic bottle that has, you know, fresh water in it, that if it's put in the ocean, you don't want that, but if it gets there, if it could fully biodegrade, that would be very, very important. But it's also got a congressional foundation set up to permanently fund some of these critical areas of innovation through private sector donations. And then to your question, Dan, it's got a really big component of working with international partners to help them with regard to their waste management systems, which, by the way, is a great opportunity for American businesses to do business over there to get them up to speed. But you're right, the estimates are upwards of 80% of all the plastic waste in the world's oceans come from 10 rivers in Asia and Africa, 80. Right. So this is a solvable problem, and it's targetable, solvable, and we have legislation that's a really, really important progress towards doing it.
So let's pivot in the time we have left to talk about a couple of the international issues. One is you've been very focused on competition, not economic competition, but strategic competition in the Arctic.
Yes.
And you've been a leader in that. What do you see as the issues there?
Well, look, this is one of these issues where, as I mentioned, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, the Commerce Committee, the Environment and Public Works Committee, and the Veterans Affairs Committee, all really critical committees for my state and fit my background. But one of the frustrations I had when I came to the Senate was nobody was really focused on the Arctic except the Alaska delegation. So what we've been doing, the Congress has been leading on this. Every year in the National Defense Authorization Act, we've been putting legislation demanding an Arctic strategy, demanding the authorization of polar class icebreakers, of which we only have two right now and one is broken, right? I think we have less icebreakers in Singapore. Russia has 54. Some of which are nuclear powered, many of which are weaponized. And we've been pressing the Pentagon through legislation to say, wake up. This is a strategic area of the world. America is an Arctic nation because of Alaska. And what you're finding is what I call, Dan, an awakening on these issues. Talked about basing icebreakers in the Arctic. That will be Alaska. I have no doubt about that. And so there's been an awakening of our need, of our strategic interests. We're way behind, as you know, the Chinese are even up in the Arctic, and it's the issues of transportation routes, given the receding sea ice, resources, certainly, oil, gas, minerals, the environment, it's very important that we protect it. The strategic aspects of where the Arctic is in terms of sea routes and military strategy. And then finally, the people. And the people happen to be my constituents. Starting to happen. We have a long way to go, but we are recognizing just how important and strategic this part of the world is, and that America is an Arctic nation, and we are because of the great state of Alaska.
Yeah. Well, you gave a major speech last year about China, where you talked about firm strategic engagement, I think is the term you used.
Yes.
You didn't use competition. You didn't use rivalry. You have a long experience in Asia in many different ways, dealing with China. How do we have a productive relationship with the other major economy in the world in which we're in so many ways connected? but at the same time, there's rising tension around it.
The United States has awoken to the challenge. The point of my speech last year was, you know, considered a little hawkish at the time, was that we are in a new Cold War with China. And I said, it wasn't a Cold War that we have sought, but it's something that's upon us. And what I talked about was kind of in my experience, and I spent a lot of time there, is that, you know, there was a very important speech by a very wise strategic American official, Bob Zelick, who used to be the U.S. trade rep and deputy secretary of state and head of the World Bank. When he was deputy secretary, he gave this speech, very well known in Asia, called the Responsible Stakeholder Speech, essentially saying to China, hey, look, the system that the United States put together after World War II has benefited you, China, probably better than any other country in the world. And you are not just, you shouldn't just take advantage of it. You should be a stakeholder in it and to promote it because it's benefited you and you've got to kind of step up to the next level of responsibility. The Chinese definitely contemplated this offer of being a responsible stakeholder with the US-led system. They've rejected it. This is a huge challenge. So what should we do? You know, in that speech, I put forward a number of things I thought that would be important. Again, we're not going to have containment. So what I said was, we need to do things like demand reciprocity in all aspects of the relationship. We just don't have it. Make our country more competitive so we can outcompete the Chinese. Continue to rebuild our military. Certainly strengthen and deepen our network of alliances. And then finally, and I think this is a really important one, you know, I'm the chairman of the International Republican Institute. We have to make sure that we promote our values, particularly our democratic values abroad.
Well, let me turn back to home now in the last couple of questions here. You gave a very moving speech in the Senate about the protests and the turmoil in the country and the influence of Condoleezza Rice's writings on that. Maybe you might just give us a sense of how you've responded to it and what you're
thinking. Yes, you know, I mean, I think like the rest of our country watching the slow motion murder of George Floyd was a shock and disgusting. And, you know, the people who are protesting peacefully in our streets, in my view, that's the best spirit of America over something like this. And, you know, I think everybody's been struggling on how and in what way we need to respond to address what are clearly still big issues of racism in America. And of course, we are working collectively here in the Senate on a number of approaches, and we've been having discussions on this. But I was particularly struck by my former boss's op-ed, as you mentioned, Condoleezza Rice. I worked for her for 5 years. I think the world of her, one of the smartest people and most insightful people I have ever met in my life. Gracious. And she wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post last week that I would, you know, encourage everybody listening to read, because she lays out a couple things. Obviously, she's had her own experiences, dramatic experiences with this kind of racism growing up in the Jim Crow South in Birmingham, Alabama. But she also mentions that there's certainly been progress. One of the ways we need to continue to make progress, even though this could be a moment for much more progress, is to make sure that, and what you see in Washington a lot is that the finger pointing doesn't immediately stall progress, right? She talks about, hey, if we're gonna make progress, we gotta check the recrimination approach at the door and work together. And then finally, she emphasizes that I think was really important. Of course, there's need for collective action, but everybody, every American, with their what drives them, what they're passionate about, can also play a role individually. And she talks about her passion is education and what she has been doing and what she's going to continue to do in that realm. I mentioned, and it was kind of an interesting coincidence, that certainly one of my passions is the military. And just this past week, we confirmed, and I was very involved with this, the new chief of staff of the United States Air Force. Very important, just given that confirmation, But this General C.Q. Brown is the first African-American ever to be a service chief in the U.S. military. So before him, the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, the Navy, the Coast Guard has never had an African-American service chief. To me, that seems puzzling. It seems actually troubling. So what I'm doing in my own kind of role as a senator who cares about these issues, looking into that, why has it taken so long in an institution, the U.S. military, that really has been in many ways a leader in desegregation for our entire country. Why is this taking so long? Is there something happening at the top of our military leadership that prevents very capable and patriotic and qualified minority leaders to achieve that top rank? It's something I'm going to look into individually. And I think what Condoleezza Rice did was challenge every American to address these issues in their own way. And I think that's a really constructive way to look at these challenges right now.
Well, thank you, Senator Sullivan. So as a last question, you're coming to the end of your first term. Reflect on being a senator, and in particular, how the institution works, as opposed to what we might see as in the media and so forth.
Well, Dan, you know, as you can imagine, a lot of my focus is certainly on my state and the great people of Alaska who I represent. And, you know, a lot of the areas that we were talking about, resource development, energy, rebuilding the military, infrastructure, particularly for our rural communities, cleaning up the oceans. These issues matter, certainly to all of America. They really matter to my constituents. And I've also worked on, you know, issues of very personal, difficult one to talk about, personal because I've been working on it since the time I was Attorney General. But, you know, our country has big problems with issues of domestic violence and sexual assault. Unfortunately, my state has huge problems with that. And that's another area that I've tried to lead on in the Senate after focusing on that during my time as Attorney General. Matters to Alaska, matters to America. So those are the kind of issues that I've focus on, things that really matter to my state, the people I represent, but also matter to the whole country. But one thing I do think happens is that the progress that you see, right, where there's bipartisan work, and in the Senate, almost everything is bipartisan. You know, we just passed out last night on the way probably to one of the biggest lands conservation pieces of legislation in a half century last night on the Senate floor. The issues relating to the pandemic, the CARES Act was 96-0. My ocean legislation. These are all the work that I've done on more legal services for survivors of domestic violence. Again, passing, signed into law. These are all areas where there's dramatic, significant bipartisan accomplishments. The highway bill, infrastructure. And yet you never read about it. You don't read about it. And I think it's dispiriting for the people we represent, for the average American, because all they think is that, wait, all you guys do is you go there, you fight, you don't like each other, it's all partisanship and nothing gets done. That's not true. And I think it's important for Americans to do we have principled differences? Absolutely, we do. But do we have ways that we can disagree in a positive way? Yeah. That happens all the time. Some of my closest friends in the Senate are on the other side of the aisle. I don't agree with them on everything, but I just wanted to end that way because there's a lot more bipartisanship that goes on here.
Well, Senator Sullivan, thank you very much for joining us for this CERAWeek conversation. We've ranged widely from energy to infrastructure to the oceans to great strategic issues, and very happy to be able to end on that affirmative note and the work that you do, working both for the people of Alaska and with your colleagues in the Senate, working for the nation. So thank you very much for joining us on a CERAWeek conversation.
And thank you, Dan, and keep up the great work. You know, I'm one of your biggest fans in the whole world, and what you've been doing and how you've educated people like me, not just through your great writings. The Prize is still my favorite book. It's right on my shelf here in the Senate. The work you've done throughout your career has just been great, and we really, really appreciate it. So thanks again. Always a pleasure to be back at CERAWeek, even if we're having to do it through Zoom.
Yeah, so next time we're together, we'll do it in person.
I hope so. I hope so soon.
Thank you, Adit.
Hey, thanks again.
So we've been talking with Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska. Thank you for joining us for this CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Markit.